Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Friday. It's February 21st and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. Our guest today will be none other than Elliot Engel. He is the congressman representing the 16th New York State District. And we're going to talk to him at about 10:10 when he'll come on. Just to give you an understanding of what we're going to be talking to him about, we're going to speak to him about his thoughts and perspectives on many concerns that he speaks to, particularly on the international as well as the domestic, on the domestic political platform. We're going to learn the issues that he's brought forward in as a sponsor or as a co-sponsor of legislation that has passed. And to be honest with you, I find that the most compelling issue with respect to political office holders that represent the public is what they accomplish on the legislative stage, because let's face it, that's what defines our elected officials. What do they do when they are in office? What issues concern them? And why does it concern them? And some people will say all kinds of different things about one legislator or the other, and some people say they're lazy, or some people say they're industrious. It makes no difference, but at the end of the day, how you define them or how they look to you, what does matter is their final product. And the product that they produce is recognizable only when you look and become aware of the legislation that they endorse, that they promoted, that they got support from their colleagues with respect to what they can do in their world. Like, for example, when we talk about Elliot Engel, he represents, he's a congressman, he's also known as representative. So he's the representative, which means he's a member of the House, and he can only impose, after getting corroboration from other people who support his concepts and ideas that he places in legislative format, in legal format. So if that's approved, he only has sway and in the House of Representatives. Then you've got another aspect of government, and that is the U.S. Senate. And the Senate is a completely different animal, and they are like the upper house, whereas the House of Representatives is like the lower house, if you want to compare it to the English form of government, which I think a lot of it has to do, there are similarities between the English form of government and the U.S. form of government. So there's an upper house and a lower house and so on and so forth. So what's interesting is that the Democrats are the majority in the House of Representatives. On the other side of the aisle, you've got the senators in the U.S. Senate, and that is predominantly Republican. So you've got that divide there, and there are some things that can and do gain credence and support within the House of Representatives that also gain credence and support in the United States Senate. Sometimes it doesn't happen. So I guess the first hurdle is getting support and credibility for one's concepts and ideas within their own realm, within their own territorial influence, which in the case of Congressman Engel is just that, within the House. And then once it passes muster there, then it can move on, and hopefully we'll get supported by by the Republican majority as well. So that's really the whole thing. So we're going to be learning within about 5 minutes when he calls up. We're going to be on the second anniversary of the Parkland shooting, in which 17 innocent lives were killed, and he has created legislation with respect to that. Also, he's introduced legislation to combat the nation's gun violence crisis. And let me see, there was one other thing I think that we were going to do as well. Oh, yes. And that was the other thing is the President of the United States, and not just this one, but others as well, have engaged in dismissing the authority of Congress to become engaged in warlike scenarios without getting or using military force without getting authority from Congress. And evidently, that is one of the principles of governance in the United States. So a president might respond, for example, to an issue, but within 30 days, within that 30-day period of responding to a particular altercation, wherever it happens to be, and the chiefs of staff, and of course the president, and everybody else involved in making these decisions to take the issue and engage in a battle of some sort, then within that 30-day period, the president must return with, I guess, a summary of why they entered into this conflict and the integrity of the and purpose of their involvement in it. And certainly with this particular president, there have been questions whether he has a right to do what he does and whether he involved the United States in conflict that he was never authorized to get, or that allocations for funding certain purposes were somehow commandeered, even though allocations were made for one thing, he's commandeering the funding for some other purpose. So that's where a lot of these things happen and come into play. What is evident, though, I think in this particular juncture in our political system, is that probably due to personalities, then you are having a tremendous amount of disconcern or just conflict between the President of the United States, Congress, and a lot of people, not necessarily just in the House of Representatives, but also the Senate, that rail against what's being said by the President. But I wonder if we can put everything into the box that it needs to be. And it's interesting as well, because my question is, well, why is this such a big issue this time, and why wasn't it a big issue 10 years ago? So is it personalities that are driving the equation forward? And then therefore, what is the, I guess, the catalyst for this sort of thing when one wants to study it? And that's about it. The other thing is, well, we should also know that the representative Engel, he's also involved this year. He will be running for re-election. And I guess the thing to really study in order to be able to better understand the perspective of our representatives is simply to see what sort of legislation that they're able to author. And then from there, we can really move on to better understand the purpose and the intent and the demeanor of the people who are in elected office. One thing that's very interesting, he's definitely a trooper. He's been around for a few years in the House of Representatives and holds some unbelievable portfolios that are under his belt. He's the chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. That's huge. And he's also on the House Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. He's a member of that. And there's just so much that he's been able to accrue in the years in office that it is actually quite compelling to recognize that the system, when the system engages people who've climbed up the food chain, so to speak, within the House of Representatives or within the Senate, they have tremendous amount of clout, and they help drive the equation forward. And one thing that I always found compelling with respect to Eliot Engel is that he has an unbelievable capacity and an interest to engage so many people that not they're not all Democrats, but he always is looking for the other side of the aisle for support. So he gets a lot of Republican support, he gets a lot of Democratic support, and that I think speaks very well, not just for the integrity and veracity of the legislation that he's being put forward, that he puts forward, but rather because it eclipses the political divide. And that makes it inclusive because there's got to be a rationale for why one individual from adhering to a particular dogma will decide to go to another, to a legislation that is being formulated and proposed. So evidently the political aspect, they may have some influence, but the political aspect of legislation is probably eclipsed because of its integrity that goes beyond that level of maybe there's a complexity with regard to political perspective, political dogma, but it rises above that. And so otherwise it wouldn't get support from other people, particularly on the other side of the aisle. And that really speaks very, very highly of what's going on here. So we'll just see where that goes. Anyway, it looks like he's running a little bit late for whatever reason. So let me just look quickly and see what else is happening here. And all right. Well, you know what? We'll take a quick break and find out what we're doing here at the Yonkers Tribune. And while we await, oh, here he is. Good morning. Mr. Engel, how are you, sir? Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, I'm so excited that you've made the time because it's not like you got free time, you know, as a representative in the U.S. House of Congress. So, first of all, I wanted to celebrate some of the things that you've done, and I find the best way of celebrating people who are in elected office is to see what they do, what's the end product. And you've got some fascinating items that you have won approval for by your colleagues as well as people from the other side of the aisle within the House that you've been able to pass. One of the most interesting was, of course, you're the chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, and you were involved in putting into order what has been allowed to languish, and that is not to that permitted the president to not request authorization from Congress to continue to engage in activity abroad that usually involved the military. How was that allowed to languish, and how have you changed that course of conduct now with your legislation?
Well, of course, that's really an excellent question. First of all, the Constitution clearly states that the power to declare war rests with Congress, not with the president,
yes,
but with Congress. What Congress has done is been very derelict in its duties because we have not had the Congress declare war since World War II, since December 7th, 1941, that famous speech that President Roosevelt gave before the Congress. And since that time, Congress has sort of eroded its responsibility. It hasn't really authorized things to do. We did have the, as you mentioned, the authorization for war back in 2001, 2002. And what has happened since that time is that every president uses that AUMF, or the authorization for war, as a excuse or as a reason to go to war. In other words, they're saying, well, Congress has already approved it, so we can just go to war. And people like myself are saying, no, wait a minute, that was a different war. Yes. That was 20 years ago. That you cannot just get a blank check because we passed something 20 years ago to just use it to go to whatever war you deem is necessary. And so many of us are pushing back. We had a bill that essentially tells the president that he cannot do this. I led the debate on the House floor, being the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee. And I think we are coming close to a bipartisan agreement, although a lot of politics, as you know, gets involved. And, you know, but it's absolutely ludicrous to for Congress not to reassert its clear power under the Constitution, sole power to declare war. And so I've been very, very vocal about that. And I think we are gaining support, bipartisan support on both sides of the aisle.
How do you view this issue? Why did Congress relinquish its responsibility in the past, like you said, since World War II? And why has it now changed course and it become more relevant that we do change the equation where the president needs to get authority? I think it's within 30 days of any conflict. He and the chief of staff agree are important. Is it a personal thing against President Trump, or is it just an understanding that too much has been allowed to, to evaporate, and the authority of Congress is what stabilizes our nation, doesn't it? So why don't we follow all the rules and regulations?
Well, we should, of course. Different rules and regulations are interpreted different ways. But I think what's happening now is, you know, look, we were talked into wars, which turned out to not be very good, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you look back now and see the past 20 years, I think that we made grievous errors in terms of committing ourselves and getting involved in what seems like never-ending war. And I think that, at least with me, let me speak for me, I'm not opposed if there is a real threat to the nation. You have to defend the nation. No one's doubting that. But you cannot.
Right.
You have to go, the president has to go to Congress. You just cannot say, well, 20 years ago we passed this bill, and now we're going to use it for this particular instance. People like me are saying, no, that's not good enough, and we're not going to stand for it anymore. So we have my colleagues, Ro Khanna and Barbara Lee, have put forth legislation. Again, I've championed it on the House floor. We had a great debate. We won that vote, and we're going to keep pushing forward. And it has nothing to do with Trump. It was just as bad when it was done by Obama and done by George W. Bush. We're not going to put up with it anymore.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. If you don't mind, unless you have another point you want to make about this issue, I was wondering if we could go over to the Parkland shooting incident that you were eloquently willing to commemorate. It's the second anniversary. And quite often in America, we have this propensity to wring our hands in disgust while it's happening, and then we forget about it. So I have to applaud you for remembering it, but not just to remember it and commemorate what happened and the loss of 17 innocent lives, but that you have taken conduct that attempts to ameliorate some of these things. So talk about the legislation that you found was pertinent to create based on this atrocity from 2 years ago.
Well, you know, we have been very frustrated in terms of not getting any sensible gun control legislation passed in the Congress. We've passed it in the House. Mitch McConnell has done so many times these past few years, has just refused to take it up. And so, obviously, you need two houses to pass a bill and the president to sign it. We don't even get to the point of the president signing it because the Senate doesn't even vote on the bill. He blocks it. And it's really just irresponsible, and we are not going to just stand for it and be quiet about it. We're going to make a big thing about it because it is a big thing. If they want to debate our bills that we pass on sensible gun control in the House, and vote it down, that's their business. But to not even bring it up, to refuse to have, you know, work the way of the people that we're supposed to represent, I think is absolutely disgraceful. And so I went down to Parkland because it was the anniversary of the terrible shooting. I mean, I can't even imagine sending, you know, kids to, your kids to school one morning. Like, it seems like an ordinary morning, and then the kids get just shot down and killed. I mean, it's just horrific. I can think of nothing that's worse than that. And you know, they twiddle their thumbs in the Senate, and Mitch McConnell twiddles his thumbs and does the bidding of the president and just doesn't bring things up. And I think that's awful. And I don't think we should be in the pocket of any president. We should have learned from our mistakes. We had terrible mistakes, in my opinion, with the Iraq War, with the Iraq War, with the Afghanistan War, and now we don't want an Iran War. And if there is going to be an Iran War, then Congress needs to vote on it. It just can't be, you know, giving the president carte blanche to do as he pleases.
Well, I forgot to mention, you're also on the a member of the House Gun Violence Prevention Task Force. So this informed you as well, because you're also responsible for that. Why is it that the Background Check Act, that's something that you supported, that H.R. 8, the Bipartisan Background Check Act? Why have we done such a poor job in getting a background check? And why did we drop the ball there? I mean, it's not your responsibility to have dropped the ball, but somehow or another, are we becoming lazy as in our Congress, in our House of Representatives, or what's the cause of all this?
Well, that's a very good question, and I can answer it. I can answer it with three letters: NRA, National Rifle Association.
That's a great answer.
They have effectively blocked every sensible gun control proposal that we have passed. Even the president had the nerve at the State of the Union to talk about gun control, or say, I forget how he phrased it, but it was something about something sensible. But he won't sign it. They won't even bring it up in the Senate. So, no, the NRA prevents Republicans and even some Democrats, but it's mostly Republicans, from voting on the bill, from having sensible gun control legislation. And in my opinion, any member of Congress that won't vote for sensible gun control legislation ought to be voted out of office. I don't care what party they're from. This is, we're sort of numb. You know, how many times when we first heard, you know, the first time this happened, it was in Columbine in school. That was, I think, the first time it was a mass shooting.
Yeah.
We were stunned. Now we're not even stunned anymore. We're numb. You know, we're just numb. We're so used to hearing it, it doesn't even sound like it's a big deal anymore. And it's a terribly big deal, and we should never get complacent with kids' lives or anybody's lives. And I'm proud that the National Rifle Association in its ratings gave me an F rating. That's the first time I ever got an F that I was proud of.
I would be proud of that too.
Right.
Good for you.
Right.
Well, I wanted to ask you about something else that quite often we forget. You know, people always talk about background checks and stuff like that. I really question whether we have that all in place, or that it's, whether it's functioning, even though it is in place by law. And there's the corollary that you brought up, which is what I find so compelling, and that is you've created something that most people are unaware about, the Safe Gun Storage Act. Then there's also risk. You forbade the use of armor-piercing bullets act, which is unbelievable because people don't realize that it pierces all sorts of protective gear.
And so there's no reason.
What made you think of that?
Well, first of all, we know that they have armor-piercing bullets, and there's no reason for you know, the average person to need that. And you know, people complain who are NRA people that we're opposed to the Second Amendment rights, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
It's a bunch of baloney because, first of all, why would anybody, if they are going to just try to protect themselves or if they are using guns for whatever reason, why would anyone need bullet-piercing guns that bullets that pierce through armor? It's a threat to our law enforcement. It's a threat to the police. It's not something that the average person would need. And so it's just a bunch of phony nonsense. and we want to expose it. Also, we want to make sure that the guns are put away and stacked up so that a four-year-old can't go over, as has happened numerous times, you know, goes over to where there are actually loaded guns, not locked up, you know, pulls the trigger and kills himself or kills a sibling. Or so if you just look at common sense stuff, you get lots of ideas for lots of new bills and legislation, because it's just simple. So the bottom line is nobody is not wanting to say to people, you don't have Second Amendment rights. That's nonsense. What we're saying is that it needs to be monitored, it needs to be checked, and sensible legislation, for instance, background checks. Why would we want to issue a gun to someone who has mental health problems? I mean, why would we want to? It's just crazy. Because of some kind of esoteric feeling we have that everybody's entitled to a gun? Baloney. If you have a problem, a mental problem or a criminal record, or you're not entitled to a gun, period. And so I think these things are just sensible, common sense principles, and I and others are going to continue to fight it every step of the way.
Well, Mr. Engel, how is it that is there a way to ameliorate the schism, the divide between the House and the Senate, or is that strictly governed by political dogma? Can that be eclipsed somehow, or is that just not doable?
Maybe it should be doable in this particular administration.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it should be doable, but of course Mitch McConnell has, you know, delayed and refused to do things. I mean, the most outrageous thing was the filling of the Supreme Court seat, where President Obama nominated a very highly qualified and well thought of judge. There was still 11 months to go in the Obama administration, and Mitch McConnell said, well, no, the president's a lame duck, and he's not going to allow it to get to the floor. I mean, it's outrageous. And it's all this kind of politics. And I think, you know, Mitch McConnell and the leadership in the Senate are doing this, and they ought to be called to continue to be called to task for it.
And that is, does our system permit the expression of consternation, of pushback? Are we getting an equal treatment within media, where they can understand, and the public can thereby, through media, understand what the issues really are?
Well, I think it's up to us.
No, we've changed. It is up to you. Okay.
It's up to us. You know, we have to make our case, because the other side, you know, I disagree with them. I think they're ill-informed about this, but they're not dumb.
Mm-hmm. No, they're not.
So we have to let the public understand what's really at stake here and what's happening and why we feel so strongly about gun control. You know, growing up in New York, as I did, and living in New York, it's a whole different world out there from the rest of the country. You go out to middle America, and people think their guns are the most important things that they have. And, you know, we want people to know we don't want to take away anyone's gun rights, but we certainly have the right to control it and legislate on it, because we have the right to make sure that people are not dying with senseless gun violence, and unfortunately there's been too much of that in this country.
And, well, I don't want to stretch beyond your time limit, because there are constraints in life. So
we'll have to absolutely.
Well, I'll work with your office to see when that works for you. Any last words, Congressman?
Well, I think that people have a right to expect Congress to represent them. We have three branches of government. All of us learned it when we were growing up in school: the legislative branch, which is the Congress, and the judicial branch, which is the courts, the Supreme Court, and the executive branch, which is the president. And it doesn't mean, and they're all equal. So we have allowed our system to erode in the past several years, where the executive branch, the president, has far outflanked everything else. And so as a result, we now have an unequal law, an unequal constitution. We've got to get back to interpreting the Constitution the way it was meant to be, and that's three co-equal branches of government, each one having the power to check the other, each one being a co-equal branch of government. We've got to get back to that. We're not a dictatorship, and we can't act like one.
Those are great words. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your
Thank
time.
You very
All
much.
The best,
My pleasure. Take care.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Here we have it, folks. Congressman Elliot L. Engel. I don't know why I remember his middle initial, but I do. Elliot L. Engel, he is the United States Representative for New York's Congressional District 16. So he represents people in Westchester County as well as in the borough of the Bronx in New York City. Well, very, very compelling. Let's quickly find out what we're doing at our end of the divide here, as they say, from the not the political divide, but actually from the radio divide. So let's find out what we're doing over at the Yonkers Tribune, and then we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. If you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, and we hope you do, then you could reach us now at one number. And that number is good for our office, good for our cell, good for our text message, and also to leave a voicemail message. And that number is 347-415-4326. So 347-415-4326. Well, let's go on and see what's happening around the world, because there's a lot that's going on. One second. So let's quickly look to see what's happening. And I guess one of the things that we were, in a sense, alluding to is evidently a week-long reduction in violence to start at midnight, so says the Taliban Afghan officials, but that's because we already hear that there will be, at the end of the month, by February 29th, there will be a signing of stopping the violence completely. So there will be a peace treaty, so we understand. International and Taliban forces will observe a 7-day period of reduced violence in Afghanistan beginning at midnight, an Afghan official and Taliban leader said today. Well, the agreement was struck during protracted negotiations between the United States and Taliban representatives that began in Qatar in 2018 and could lead to a withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan, they said. But like we said, we expect it to happen on the 29th of April, February. Well, based on the plan, the reduction in violence, the RIV will start between the Taliban and international and Afghan security forces for 1 week. So says Javid Faisal, the spokesman for the Afghan National Security Advisor, who spoke to Reuters about that. We hope it is extended for a longer period and opens the way for a ceasefire and intra-Afghan talks, he added. Well, isn't that sweet? But I just told you, February 29th. Anyway, three senior Taliban leaders, two in Doha and one in Afghanistan, also confirmed to Reuters that they had agreed on reduction of violence in Afghanistan for 7 days starting Friday night. Well, isn't that sweet? Well, why don't they tell us that they also plan to sign the agreement? Anyway, all three spoke on condition of anonymity. Thank you very much. The Taliban is expected to make a formal announcement of the RIV later on Friday. Well, that must be already there, but we haven't gotten the latest report. So one Taliban leader based in Doha told Reuters that the period could not be called a ceasefire. Oh, it's going to be just the signing of a peace treaty. Ooh. Okay, well, every party has a right of self-defense, but there would be no attacks on each other's positions in these 7 days. The Taliban leader said, isn't that sweet? You just got to love the way this is. Isn't it great? Isn't it great to be able to get a real sense of what's going on and how they're playing the game? Oh, it's just so exciting. I love this part of the business. Anyway, quote, it is to create a security environment in Afghanistan and can be extended if things go well. Isn't that sweet? The intimate there that maybe if things go well after signing of a peace accord with the United States, he added, isn't that special? We just said it was going to happen, but he didn't tell you that. Well, anyway, officials said last week that an agreement with the Taliban would be followed by negotiations on an intra-Afghan political settlement between the Taliban and an Afghan delegation that would include government officials. Well, the Taliban had previously refused to speak directly to the Kabul government, which they denounced as a U.S. puppet. Afghan forces will keep up normal military operations against other terrorist groups such as Daesh, that is the Islamic State, but that's a pejorative Arab word, Daesh, or Islamic State, during the RIV period, Faisal had said, adding that Afghan forces will also retaliate to the smallest violation of the understanding by the Taliban. Quote, well, it's like a little, you know, jab in there. But anyway, local government, quote, local government and security officials have been instructed by the president himself on how to follow the regulations agreed upon for the RIV period, he said. And U.S. officials were not immediately available for comment, but U.S. and Taliban negotiators have been meeting in Doha since 2018, even though fighting has raged on in Afghanistan and thousands of civilians and combatants have been killed as the insurgents have expanded their territorial control. Well, isn't that special? Well, now it looks like 20 years later, it's coming to an end. Now, let's look and see what's going on close by. Iran. Iran has voted in elections dominated by conservative candidates. Isn't that a choice word? Iranians were voting on Friday for a new parliament, which conservatives are expected to dominate, with turnout seen as a key measure of support for Iran's leadership as sanctions weigh on the economy and isolate the country diplomatically. The disqualification of some 9,000 potential candidates, most of them reformists and moderates, by Iran's powerful Guardian Council raised the possibility of lower than usual turnout. Reporting from the capital, Tehran, France 24's Reza Saya said that the Guardian Council this year had around 90 sitting moderate or reformist lawmakers, leading many Iranians to question whether the Friday vote was a legitimate democratic exercise. In other words, what you have to understand here is that people who vie for political office need to get approval from the Guardian Council, even though they may be tenured in their position. They still have to get authority by the Guardian Council. So the Guardian Council actually defines who will be permitted to stand before the public in the hope that those that they permit will be voted upon, but they will not permit those that they feel are deleterious or undermine their governance. So that needs to be understood. So analysts quote, analysts say this apparent purge of reformists is an indication that Iran's establishment is reshaping the government from one that was led by the moderates and reformists. So, you know, these are unbelievable words, who wanted open relations with the West, who wanted the 2015 nuclear deal, to one that now will be dominated by conservatives and hardliners who are going to take a much more firm stance against the United States, implementing more anti-U.S. policies, which doesn't bode well for what's left of the nuclear deal and improved relations with the United States, noted Saya. Well, tensions with the United States hit an all-time high this year following a U.S. airstrike, which killed Iran's top general, Qassem Soleimani. The strike led to a confrontation in which Iranian forces accidentally shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane after it took off from Tehran, killing all 176 people on board. Most of those killed were Iranian. And the shootdown and attempts by officials to initially conceal the cause of the crash sparked public anger and protests in Iran, which were violently put down by the administration. Now, on Thursday, Washington slapped sanctions on five Iranian officials in charge of vetting candidates, including Ahmadinejad, a powerful cleric. The Trump administration will not tolerate the manipulation of elections to favor the regime's maligned agenda, quote-unquote, said U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Well, the Guardian Council slammed the sanctions, saying they showed U.S. disdain for democracy. Well, America's regime has shown through illegal sanctions on members of the Guardian Council that it has nothing to do with democracy, end quote, said a spokesman Abbas Ali Hadhodai, who was among those hit with sanctions. Quote, we are now even more determined to safeguard the people's vote, end quote, he tweeted. Well, isn't that special? Well, turnout in Friday's elections is widely viewed as a critical test of the legitimacy of Iran's democratic process, with the state unleashing all stops to encourage Iranians to vote. On the eve of the election, state media aired a short clip showing votes transforming into torpedoes hitting enemy Navy ships closing in on Iran. Hessamedin Ashena, a senior advisor to President Hassan Rouhani, warned on Twitter that abstention, quote, increases, among other things, the possibility of a military aggression. Whew. Well, turnout in Iran's past 10 elections averaged 60.5%, according to the Interior Ministry. The Guardian Council said it expected at least 50% of registered voters to cast ballots. Many voters, however, have voiced disinterest. Quote, we voted for Mr. Rouhani with a dream, and then we didn't achieve anything. So, in my opinion, people are not hopeful anymore, said Mohammed, who spoke from his carpet shop and only gave one name. I honestly don't want to vote because it won't fix our problems and is of no use, and this election is only a formality just so they can show to the world that they are chosen by the nation, while it is not so, said Ahazadeh, a fashion designer. In November, demonstrations of the gasoline prices or petrol price hikes spread across Iran and turned violent before being crushed in a deadly crackdown. Tehran and Washington have nearly gone to war twice in the past 7 months, most recently after the United States assassinated prominent Iranian General Qassem Soleimani on January 3rd. The martyrdom, quote-unquote, of the hugely popular general provoked an outpouring of grief in Iran, and millions of people turned out to mourn his death. But that unity suffered a blow after Iran finally admitted that it had shot down a Ukrainian airliner on January 8th, killing 176 people. Well, the government sparked further anger by denying for several days that Iran was to blame, before owning up to a jittery reaction by a missile operator. Well, the disaster unfolded as Iran's defenses were on high alert in case the U.S. retaliated to Iranian strikes hours earlier on American troops stationed in Iraq in response to the killing of Soleimani. Well, voting for the parliament, or majlis, last 10 hours, but can be extended. Final results are not expected before Sunday. And apart from the parliament, voters will also choose replacements for deceased members of the Assembly of Experts, 88 strong clerical body that appoints and monitors the supreme leader. Well, my God, there's so much going on. Isn't that unbelievable? Well, it just goes to show you that's the way it is. Anyway, there's a lot going on, that is for sure. One moment here. Yes, this is very, very important. Germany has tightened security at mosques, other sites, after far-right shootings. Well, Germany's top security official said on Friday that authorities will step up the police presence throughout the country and keep a closer watch on mosques and other sites after the racially motivated shootings that killed 9 people. A 43-year-old German man fatally shot the victims of immigrant background in the Frankfurt suburb of Hanau on on Wednesday night before killing his mother and himself. The man, identified as Tobias Ratjen, left a number of rambling texts and videos espousing racist views and claiming to have been under a surveillance since birth. Interior Minister Horst Seehofer said that state-level security officials and security agencies he consulted on Thursday agreed to increase the law enforcement presence around the country, and Seehofer had said that there would be more surveillance at sensitive sites, quote unquote, including mosques, and a high police presence at railway stations, airports, and borders. Well, the attack came amid mounting concern about far-right extremism reflected in earlier attacks and the rise of the anti-immigrant party, Alternative für Deutschland, which means Alternative for Germany. That's the name of the party. Well, thousands of people gathered in cities across Germany on Thursday evening to hold vigils for the shooting victims as calls grew for authorities to crack down on far-right extremism. A top official in the center-left Social Democratic Party, a junior party in Chancellor Angela Merkel's governing coalition, Alternative for Germany Party, of providing ideological fodder to people like the Hanau shooter. Quote, one person carried out the shooting in Hanau. That's what it looks like. But there were many that supplied him with ammunition, and the Alternative for Germany party definitely belongs to them, Lars Klingbeil had told German public broadcaster ARD on Friday. Now, parts of Alternative for Germany party already were under close scrutiny from Germany's domestic intelligence agency. The party has rejected all responsibility for far-right attacks, including an anti-Semitic attack on a synagogue and the killing of a regional politician last year. Whew. I tell you, the stuff that goes on around this world, isn't that unbelievable? Well, let's not forget what's going on in Algeria. Algerians gather in the capital to mark the anniversary of Hirak, H-I-R-A-K, protest movement. Well, Algeria this weekend marks a year since the birth of an unprecedented protest movement known as Hirak, one that quickly forced an ailing president from power and is now looking to maintain momentum. Anti-regime protesters have designated Friday and Saturday a landmark moment, mobilizing to, quote, disqualify, end quote, the system's agenda of self-renewal and to lay the foundation for a new republic. By noon, thousands of demonstrators, including women and children, were gathered peacefully in front of the central post office in Algiers, the assembly point for weekly protests. Anti-riot police were deployed but did not disperse the crowd, which chanted, "We have come to celebrate, we have come to free you," and, quote, "We're not going to stop," end quote. Checkpoints were installed on roads into the city, according to social media, complicating access to the commemoration for Algerians outside the capital. But this did not stop Bashir, who's 50, from traveling 95 miles from Ain Defla to, quote, celebrate the first anniversary of Hirak and to renew the movement's demands. Protests first erupted on February 22 of last year in response to President Abdelaziz Bouteflika announcing his intention to run for a fifth term despite being debilitated by a 2013 stroke. So it's just going to be used as a figurehead. And less than 6 weeks later, he stepped down after losing the support of the then army chief in the face of enormous weekly demonstrations. But despite hordes, diplomats said millions turning out after Bouteflika's fall to demand an overhaul of the entire system, the military maintained a political stranglehold in the months that followed. The election of Abdelmahid Tebboune, once a prime minister under Bouteflika, as president in December, appears to have reinforced the regime's hand and further stalled the protest movement. But many boycotted the poll of the elections. Even the official turnout was below 40%, and demonstrators remained numerous. Thursday evening, Tebboune paid homage to the protest movement in an interview with local media, promising to implement, quote, all of its demands, end quote, after it prevented the total collapse, quote, unquote, of the country. But in a manifesto published on Thursday, organizations from the Iraq movement called for, quote, continued mobilization, end quote, to force out members of the old guard, arguing that they could not oversee the process of reform. They denounced the state taking, quote, repressive measures, end quote, against journalists, activists, and protesters. Algerians, quote, want their country ruled and managed with transparency, end quote, by, quote, accountable officials, an independent judiciary, and a parliament that is not a rubber stamp body, end quote, they wrote. Well, Dalia Hanem, a researcher at the Carnegie Middle East Center based in Beirut, argued things in Algeria appeared much as before. Quote, soldiers have returned to their barracks, civilians are in power, so there is a democratic and constitutional facade, she said. Well, Tebboune is just the civilian face of a regime that remains in the hands of the military, end quote. But, quote, the capacity of the regime to adapt without really changing and its resilience will be tested in the coming years, she contended. It will dole out political handouts through limited reforms, she said, but an economic crisis caused by low oil prices will limit its largesse and hence its scope to maintain social peace. The protest movement, meanwhile, has plenty of rethinking ahead if it is to maintain momentum. The size of marches across the country on Friday and Saturday will represent a key test of the spontaneous, leaderless, and youth-dominated movement. Will it grasp President Tebboune's extended hand and risk being swallowed up by the regime? Or does it need to gear itself up for an institutional game with a risk of exposing its own divisions and contradictions? But whatever the challenges are ahead, Iraq has already forced change on Algeria's political order in a context where real opposition was consistently hindered, gagged, and co-opted during Bouteflika's two decades at the helm. And above all, in maintaining an overwhelmingly peaceful line, the movement has succeeded, quote, succeeded in ensuring there has been no bloody confrontation or brutal repression, end quote, said historian Karima Diresh. This marks a contrast with other countries and also Algeria's own past experience. Quote, to see Algerians congregating every Friday for the last year, women, men, Berbers, Muslim brothers, and secularists in the streets is extraordinary, said Hanem. Quote, a wall of fear has been destroyed by this new, heavily politicized generation, which knows what it wants, she said. Diresh sees the coming year in allowing, quote, stocktaking of what Algerians want collectively, end quote. If the movement succeeds, quote, Algeria could become a case study, Diresh hopes, with much resting on the coming year. Absolutely. This could be a shining light in North Africa and of the Arab world. So, unbelievable. Now, let me just quickly look. One second here. Where did I put this? Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to forget this. China has reported an uptick in the new coronavirus cases, and South Korea, the infections in South Korea have spiked. An eruption of new virus cases in South Korea, Iran, and Chinese hospitals and prisons rekindled concerns today about the spread of a deadly disease that has killed more than 2,200. Health Organization warned nations they could face a serious problem if they failed to hit hard now. Quote, end quote, against the new coronavirus, which has infected more than 75,000 people in China and over 1,100 people abroad. Now, China has pointed to official numbers showing a drop in new cases this week as evidence that its drastic containment measures are working, but fresh cases emerged at two Beijing hospitals and more than 500 others were reported in prisons across the country. Well, Chinese authorities have placed tens of millions of people under quarantine in hard-hit central Hubei province and restricted movement in other cities far from the epicenter. And countries have banned travelers from China, and airlines have suspended flights to and from the country. But clusters and outbreaks continue to emerge, and 11 people have now died outside mainland China. Chinese officials said a potential vaccine could be submitted for clinical trials around late April. South Korea on Friday confirmed 52 more cases, taking the country's overall figure to 156 as the number of infections linked to a religious sect spiked, making it the worst infected country outside China. More than 80 members of Shinseonyi Church of Jesus in the southern city of Daegu have now been infected, starting with a 61-year-old woman who developed a fever on February 10 but attended at least four church services before being diagnosed. Now, the mayor of Daegu, South Korea's fourth biggest city with a population of over 2.5 million, has advised residents to stay indoors while access to a major U.S. base in the area has been restricted. It remained open on Friday with most people wearing masks, but many businesses were closed due to the outbreak and workers on motorcycles sprayed disinfectant outside the church. Outside the church, Seo Dong-min, 24, told Asia France Press, quote, "With so many confirmed cases here, I'm worried that Daegu will become the second Wuhan," referring to Hubei's capital where the virus first emerged. Iran confirmed three new cases after two elderly men died from the virus in the city of Qom, prompting Iraq to ban travel to and from its neighbor. Health Ministry spokesman Kayanush Jahanpour said two of the new cases were also in Qom, and the other was in Arak, south of the holy city. In Australia, two people who have been evacuated from a virus-wracked cruise ship off Japan tested positive for mild cases of the COVID-19 illness. Hundreds of people have been allowed to leave the ship after testing negative for the disease, and many have returned to their home countries to face further quarantine. The two cases in Australia will fuel questions about Tokyo's policy of allowing former Diamond Princess passengers to return home after testing negative. Two former passengers, both Japanese and in their 80s, died in Japan on Thursday. World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said on Thursday that now, quote, is the time to attack the virus, end quote, while the number of cases abroad remains low. Quote, if we don't hit hard now, using the window of opportunity, we might be faced with a serious problem, he said. This virus is very dangerous and it's public enemy number one, and it's not being treated as such. Reported 118 more deaths on Friday, raising the toll to 2,236, most of them in Hubei, that's the province where Wuhan is the capital. The National Health Commission also said in its daily update that China tallied 889 new cases. The number is up from the previous day when it reported the lowest number of new infections in nearly a month, fueling hopes that the epidemic is nearing its peak. Among those, 258 were outside Hubei, ending a 16-day streak of new infections falling in the rest of the country. New hotspots were found in prisons and hospitals. Seven guards and 200 inmates tested positive for the virus at Rensheng Prison in eastern Shandong province. Eight officials were fired over the issue. An official newspaper in Hubei reported 230 cases at the Wuhan Women's Prison, whose warden was dismissed, and 41 others at another penitentiary in Shaoyang County. Another 34 cases have been found in Shilifeng Prison in eastern Zhejiang province, leading to the ouster of its director and another official. In Beijing itself, health officials said 36 people, including medical staff, patients, and other families, have now tested positive for the virus at Fuxing Hospital, which has been under partial lockdown since January 31. At Beijing or Peking University People's Hospital, a patient became infected after a visit from two relatives who tested positive for the virus. Most of China remains paralyzed over fears of contagion, with people slowly trickling back to work, schools remaining closed, and Beijing ordering returnees to self-quarantine for 14 days. Whew. I tell you, the stuff that's going on is frightening. And we'll just see where this all leads. one second here. Where is this? Okay. This is very, very important. Ireland. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar has resigned after an inconclusive election result. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar resigned today, or actually was yesterday, but stayed on as interim leader while the country's three main parties battle out a coalition talks after an inconclusive election. Varadkar tendered his resignation as Daoiseach, I don't know how to pronounce it correctly, but that's the Irish or the Gaelic word for premier, to President Michael Higgins after the first sitting of Ireland's lower house of parliament since a February 8 election, which radically recast the political landscape. Quote, in accordance with the constitution, that Daoiseach and the government will continue to carry on their duties until successors have been appointed, a government statement had said. Parties in the 160-seat chamber, the Dail, or D-A-I-L, convened and nominated candidates to lead a new government as the prime minister, but with none commanding a majority, it was adjourned until March 5. Then leader Mary Lou MacDonald received the most votes backing her. At 45, it was far short of the 80 needed to take office, but it was a symbolic victory, reflecting the surge the Nationalist Party enjoyed in the election. Sinn Féin, which once served as the political wing of paramilitary Irish Republican Army, became the second biggest party with 37 seats, breaking the historic duopoly of center-right parties Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. The people who vote for us aren't going anywhere, said MacDonald. Quote, we have made a commitment to them to represent them well and make our very best effort to deliver that government of change, and that is precisely what we intend to do. MacDonald outstripped the 36 votes backing Varadkar to continue as prime minister after his Fine Gael party slipped into third position in the election with 35 seats. The onus is now on those who have made enormous promises of change to people during this election who are entrusted with that mandate to bring a program for government for the Dail for approval, Varadkar said in Parliament before departing to resign. If they cannot, they should say so and be upfront and honest about their failure and the empty promises they made. Michael Martin's Fianna Fáil party won the most seats in the election at 38, but suffered significant losses on their 2016 wins. He received the backing of 41 lawmakers on Thursday's contest. Sinn Féin has been historically associated with the IRA, which fought British rule in Northern Ireland for decades until the late 1990s, when a peace treaty largely ended violence that left more than 3,000 dead on all sides. It won the popular vote with 24.5% of first preference ballots and picked up 14 seats, leaving voters with a campaign focusing on Ireland's housing shortage and health crisis. But its flagship policy on Irish unity is likely to be a top issue if it gains power. It wants a referendum on uniting the two parts of the island within 5 years. At least three parties will be needed to form a government, a majority government in the Dáil. But with the three largest refusing to cooperate, newly elected Speaker Sean O'Fearhail said that the challenge of government formation, remains substantial. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael have both ruled out working with Sinn Féin, in part because of their association to past violence. Varadkar told state broadcaster RTE on Monday he was prepared to go into opposition. Meanwhile, Sinn Féin said on Wednesday it was intensifying negotiations with smaller parties and independents seeking a government for change. Well, talks may take some time and may result in a new election in which Sinn Féin could emerge as a favorite. After a 2016 vote, it took 70 days for a minority coalition government to form under Fine Gael, which was supported by in a confidence and supply agreement by Fianna Fáil. So, my God, there's so much that's going on around the world, but they all impact us because we're in a conglomeration of people from all over the world. And that's what's going on. Then we need to really dig into some other things that we have not forgotten, and that is that Macron are seeking Syria talks with Putin and Erdogan. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President Emmanuel Macron told Russia's Vladimir Putin on Thursday they want to meet him and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan to defuse the crisis in Syria. In their phone call with President Putin, Merkel and Macron expressed their concern over the humanitarian catastrophe for residents of Syria's Idlib province, Merkel's office had said. A month-long offensive by Russia-backed Syrian troops against rebels backed by Turkey in northwest Idlib has seen close to a million civilians flee the violence. The two European Union leaders, quote, expressed their willingness to meet President Putin and Turkish President Erdogan to find a political solution to the crisis, end quote, the chancellor's office had said. Now, Merkel and Macron, quote, called for an immediate end to the fighting and unfettered humanitarian access to people in need, their statement had said. Since Syria's civil war erupted in 2011, the country has never seen so many people displaced in so short a time. In 9 years, millions of people have fled their homes and more than 380,000 have been killed. Russia on Wednesday objected to the United Nations Security Council adopting a statement that would have called for a ceasefire in Idlib, diplomats had said, after a tense closed-door meeting. The United Nations urged neighboring Turkey to admit the new displaced people, but Ankara is resisting as it already has some 3.7 million Syrians on their territory. For its part, Turkey said Thursday it wanted a, quote, face-off with Mosque Syria's offensive near the two countries' border, but said it might receive U.S. defense missiles to protect Turkish forces. Well, tensions have mounted in the last 3 months between rebel backer Turkey and Syria ally Moscow over President Bashar al-Assad's offensive in northern Idlib, the last rebel-held region in Syria. Earlier this month, 14 Turks were killed in two separate incidents of regime shelling in Idlib, and two more were killed on Thursday. We have no intentions of a face-off with Russia, Turkey's defense minister Hulusi Akar told CNN Turk broadcaster, adding talks would continue with Russian officials. One of the issues being discussed is the airspace above Idlib and Turkey's expectations for Russia not to get involved, Akar had said. There has been no concrete agreement between Russia and Turkey after two rounds of talks between their respective delegations in Ankara and Moscow earlier this month. Ankara insists that it wants to avoid a humanitarian disaster, but also wants to avoid a flow of refugees into Turkey. Turkey has 12 observation posts in Idlib province, set up after a deal signed with Russia in the Black Sea resort of Sochi in 2018 to prevent a regime offensive. There is a threat of airstrikes, missiles against our country, Akar told CNN Turk channel, adding, quote, there could be Patriot support, end quote. He was referring to the United States-made anti-missiles. Akar ruled out any U.S. troop support in an interview filmed earlier on Thursday before two Turkish soldiers were killed in Idlib on an air raid blamed on Damascus. Any delivery of U.S. Patriots would be difficult since Ankara purchased the S-400 Russian air defense system despite Washington's objectives and concerns. Despite this and the remaining threat of U.S. sanctions against Turkey over the purchase, Akar said that the system would be activated. No one should doubt this. End quote. Now, the minister said that Turkey still sought to purchase the Patriots an equivalent of S-400s despite the U.S. concern over the S-400 system. He also criticized the U.S. over its move last year to kick Turkey off its F-35 fighter jet program as punishment for the S-400 purchase. We are a partner in the program, not a customer, he added. Turkey has warned Damascus of an imminent operation if regime forces do not move back behind Ankara's military posts in Idlib. Oh, my God, the stuff that goes on, huh? Unbelievable. Well, one second here. I wanted to check some other things just to make sure that I'm covering with you. Now, let me just quickly look here, see what else is happening in maybe in our continent. One second. This is important. Evidently, Trump ally Roger Stone gets 40 months prison for obstructing Congress's Russia investigation. Donald Trump's longtime ally Roger Stone was sentenced Thursday to 40 months in prison for impeding a congressional investigation in a case that ignited a firestorm of the U.S. president's political interference in the U.S. justice system. Stone, a veteran Republican operative and one of the president's oldest confidants, was convicted in November of lying to Congress, tampering with a witness, and obstructing the House investigation into whether the Trump campaign conspired with Russia to cheat in the 2016 election. Well, the truth still matters, said U.S. District Court Judge Amy Berman Jackson, as she handed down the sentence to Stone, who will remain free while his request for a new trial is considered. Roger Stone's insistence that it doesn't, his belligerence, his pride in his own lies are a threat to our most fundamental institution, to the very foundation of our democracy. Well, Trump said soon after he believed Stone had a very good chance of being cleared in the long run, accusing the jury without evidence of being, quote, tainted, end quote. Well, the president controversially commuted the sentence this week of nearly a dozen criminals with links to his friends and political allies, including a corrupt politician and a tax fraud police chief. But he ruled out immediately issuing Stone the pardon many had been expecting. I'm going to let this process play out, he said at an event in Las Vegas. At some point, I'll make a determination. We're waiting. Well, Trump sparked outrage by decrying a, quote, miscarriage of justice, end quote, after prosecutors he smeared as corrupt recommended Stone be jailed for up to 9 years in accordance with federal sentencing guidelines. Well, the president has attacked the jury previously, as well as Jackson, who last year jailed former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort for unlawful lobbying and witness tampering. Attorney General Bill Barr, who has been blasted for being too close to Trump, personally intervened to have the extreme and excessive, quote-unquote, recommendation withdrawn, prompting all four prosecutors to quit the case. At Thursday's hearing, Jackson hit out at the extraneous commentary, quote-unquote, surrounding the case and the, quote, unprecedented action of the Department of Justice within the past week, end quote. But she added that she chose a lower sentence because she was moved by letters from Stone's relatives and friends, casting the 67-year-old grandfather as a caring family man who had helped NFL players with brain injuries, rescued dogs, and supported criminal justice reform. Stone is the sixth aide of Trump, who was impeached last year for abusing his power but acquitted by the Senate, to be convicted of charges arising from special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian election interference. Well, Barr said that the president's comments had had no impact on his decision, but has found himself vilified by Democrats who accuse him and the president of undermining the rule of law. In addition, more than 2,000 former Justice Department officials have signed a statement calling for Barr to resign. Well, in a rare public rebuke, the Attorney General said that Trump's Twitter pronouncements in ongoing cases were making his job impossible, end quote. His attempt to distance himself from the president was met with skepticism, however, by critics, who accused Barr of having repeatedly acted more like Trump's personal lawyer than a public servant. And Trump has continued in any case to be outspoken in his support for Stone, who appeared in court in a striped suit and a polka dot tie. Well, the self-avowed dirty trickster, quote-unquote, was convicted of lying in testimony to Congress about acting as an intermediary between the Trump campaign with WikiLeaks, which released documents hijacked by Russia that embarrassed rival Hillary Clinton during the 2016 White House race. Now, the seven-count indictment also accused Stone of threatening an associate and his dog to stop him cooperating with investigators. Stone accused jury members of being biased against him and appealed to overturn their verdict. Jackson had previously forbidden Stone from posting on social media about his trial after he shared a picture of her on Instagram with what appeared to be the crosshairs of a gun sight. She said on Thursday his actions had risked the safety of the court and rejected any suggestion that the case against him was brought over his political advocacy. Quote, he was not convicted and is not being sentenced for exercising his First Amendment rights, his support of the president's campaign, or his policy, said Jackson. Quote, he was not prosecuted, as some have complained, or standing up for the president. He was prosecuted for covering up for the president. Whew, my God. What is heavy duty stuff, huh? Who would have thought? Well, one second. All right. I want to cover this with you because we haven't done so yet. The Boeing has found debris in fuel tanks of the grounded 737 MAX aircraft. Boeing company found debris that could pose potential safety risks in the fuel tanks of several 737 MAX aircraft that are stored and waiting to be delivered to airlines, according to an internal memo seen by Reuters on Tuesday. Debris, an industrial term for rags, tools, metal shavings, and other material left behind by workers during the production process, has been a quality control issue for various Boeing aircraft, such as its KC-46 tankers. Mark Jenks, general manager of the 737 program, told employees in the memo that such debris was absolutely unacceptable, quote, end quote, and that the company was taking steps to address the issue in its production system. A Boeing spokesman confirmed the memo's authenticity and said Boeing does not see the debris as contributing to delays in the jet's return to service. Oh, God. Anyway, the objects were found during maintenance work on some of the hundreds of 737 MAX jetliners Boeing has built but not delivered due to a worldwide ban imposed last March following two crashes that killed 346 people, he said. And the Federal Aviation Authority did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Gotta wonder what's going on here. Just really unbelievable. Oh, God. Now let me just see what else we've got going here for you. All right, let me just go back to see what's happening in Europe. One second. All right. Okay, this is also very interesting in Germany, and then we'll go over to the Vatican. Vigils are being held in Germany for the victims of a racist gunman. Vigils across Germany on Thursday after a gunman with apparent far-right beliefs killed 9 people at a shisha bar and a cafe in the city of Hanau. Chancellor Angela Merkel condemned the poison of racism as anger fixed with grief, or rather mixed with grief, over the latest and deadliest attack linked to Germany's extreme right in recent months. The suspect, 43-year-old German Tobias R., this is his last name, the initial of his first of his last name, was found dead at his home after a rampage, along with his 72-year-old mother, in what appeared to be a murder-suicide. Well, hundreds of people, many carrying candles or a white rose, gathered in silence in Hanau in the evening to show solidarity with the victims. And large crowds also gathered in Frankfurt and at Berlin's Brandenburg Gate, some carrying signs that read, take racism personally or, quote, never again, in scenes replicated across dozens of German cities, which we spoke about earlier. So, very, very pertinent. Now, this will be a mind blower for some. Evidently, the church has no reason to fear history. So said the Vatican when they said that they would open wartime archives of Pope Pius XII. Woo. Well, more than 150 historians and researchers have signed up to access the soon to open Vatican archives of Pope Pius XII, evidence of the intense scholarly interest in the World War II era Pope and his record during the Holocaust, officials said on Thursday. Cardinal Jose Tolentino de Mendoza, the Vatican's chief librarian, told reporters that all researchers, regardless of nationality, faith, and ideology, were welcome to request permission to use the Vatican's Apostolic Library, which will open the archive on March 2nd. Church has no reason to fear history, he told reporters. Some Jewish groups and historians have said Pius, who was Pope from 1939 to 1958, stayed silent during the Holocaust and didn't do enough to save lives. His defenders at the Vatican and beyond say he used quiet diplomacy and encouraged convents and other religious institutes to hide Jews. Emeritus Pope Benedict XVI, a great defender of Pius, accelerated the process to open the archives ahead of schedule so that researchers could have their say. Pope Francis announced the archive would be ready March 2nd. One of the historians who plans to be there for the opening is David Keltzer of Brown University, author of several books about Pius's predecessors and their relations with Jews, one about Pius XI, the Pope, and Mussolini, won the Pulitzer Prize for biography in 2015. In an email, Keltzer said that the imminent opening of the Pius XII's archives and the light it will shed on the role played by the Pope during the war had, quote, generated tremendous excitement in the scholarly world and beyond, end quote. Continuing, he said, much of historical importance will also become clear for the post-war years, when the Pope, among other challenges, worried that the Communist Party would come to power in Italy and played a crucial behind-the-scenes role in blocking it, he said. Calasa de Mendoza warned that the process of studying the millions of pages of documents from six different archives will be measured in years, not days, weeks, or months, and will require patience. No scoops, quote-unquote, are expected in the near term, stressed Monsignor Sergio Pagano, the prefect of the archive. The documentation includes the archives from the Pius Secretariat of State, the main organ of church governance, which includes the Vatican's foreign relations with other countries, as well as those of the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and the Vatican Office responsible for mission territories. Jewish groups and historians have argued for years that the Vatican had no business moving forward with Pius's beatification cause until the Vatican's full archives were opened. They have also asked that any beatification be put off until the generation of Holocaust survivors have died. The American Jewish Committee, which has expressed such appeals, welcomed the opening. Quote, we trust that the independent scholarly review of these archival materials will provide greater clarity as to what positions and steps were taken during this period by the Holy See and help resolve the persistent debates and controversy in this regard, end quote, said Rabbi David Rosen, in charge of the group's interreligious affairs. He said that the necessary transparency, quote, end quote, would also enhance the already strong Catholic-Jewish relations. Benedict moved Pius' possible sainthood in December of 2009 when he confirmed that Pius lived a life of heroic Christian virtue. All that is needed now is for the Vatican to determine a miracle occurred. Pope Francis said in 2014 that the miracle hadn't been identified, suggesting that the process would remain on hold at least for now. Whew. Very, 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 very compelling stuff. So, I don't know, we move back a little bit, we move forward a little bit. It's life, it takes time, and so it goes. Now, let me just quickly check to see what else is happening. Bear with me a moment. One second. This is going to be, you may find interesting. And this is Jordan's Wadi Rum, or Wadi Rum Desert, is Hollywood's new place to film, which I think will interest a lot of people in Yonkers because we have a large Jordanian population. Its breathtaking landscapes seem out of the world, and Jordan has been the setting for dozens of Hollywood blockbusters. The splendid archaeological city of Petra was the setting for Indiana Jones, while more recently the Wadi Rum Desert welcomed the crew of Star Wars. And so that's going to be very, very compelling. Let's see, we've got a little bit of time, so actually I can play this for you. Bear with me a moment, and we'll be able
to.
We'll be able.
With the Anderson 400 series windows.
Okay, we're going to be able to do this in a moment, and just a bit of a commercial, and then we'll be able to get started. And this is for Franz Venkat. Okay, well there we are. So, let's see. It looks like we're out there. Yeah, another few seconds, and we'll be on and ready to go. All right. So, okay, here we are.
Hello, I'm Clovis Casali, and this is Middle East Matters. Coming up on the show, Syrian troops continue their northwest offensive, causing many casualties and the mass displacement of civilians. We'll bring you a rare report from that area, cut off from the world. Conservatives set to cruise to victory in Iran's parliamentary elections. This as thousands of moderates and reformist candidates are banned from running in the ballot. And finally, we'll be taking you to the breathtaking landscapes of Wadi Rum. Jordan's desert has become the place to film for Hollywood superstars. But first to Syria, where the army's offensive has led hundreds of thousands of civilians to flee their homes in the northwest of the country. Idlib province and Aleppo have long been strategic targets for Bashar al-Assad's troops. Our colleagues from France 2 got rare access to the area, but had to be escorted by the army. As the United Nations urged once again for humanitarian corridors, operations have resulted in widespread destruction, as you'll see in this report.
Syrian troops head to the front line in Idlib province. In the near distance, they're battling rebel and jihadist groups. Backed by Russian air power, they've advanced through an area that was still under opposition control at the beginning of the year.
See those trees over there? That's our most recent position. For us, recapturing this zone is a key step towards recapturing the whole country. Idlib is just a question of time, and we're very patient.
Reinforcing the front are these young soldiers. 21 years old, they evoke the government's discourse regarding the war.
We are the youth, the future of this country. There are terrorists from foreign countries who wanted to take us back to the Middle Ages. Yes, we had to take up arms at a young age, too young even, but it was to defend our land, our country.
Among their recent territorial gains, Marat al-Numan. For the army, it's strategic for its location along the M5 highway, and it's also symbolic. The city was one of the first major centers of protest against President Bashar al-Assad when the uprising began in 2011. Once home to tens of thousands of people, it's now a ghost town. After months of bombing by Assad and his Russian allies, meanwhile, the country's military crisis is being compounded by its economic crisis. At the store in Damascus, sugar has just been delivered. The government has started rationing subsidized food with these smart cards, which track and cap purchases. Without this card, I would have paid much more for this, three times more.
We expected these shortages. We noticed the jump in price for these basic necessities. These subsidies help us breathe a little bit.
A government move to attenuate public anger amid dire economic conditions. Conditions that 50-year-old Kausar Maison has now learned to live with. Her husband has disappeared, kidnapped, she says, and her son injured. We can forget the years of famine or food shortages, but when you lose a loved one, that's something you can never forget. And we've lost many. Every family, every neighbor has lost two, three, sometimes five people. An entire generation has been lost. For now, life in Syria for many remains a daily fight for survival. But after 9 years of grueling war, sparked by the government's repression of what began as peaceful protests, many are now wondering how much longer the fight will last.
Houthi rebels and Yemen's internationally recognized government have finally agreed to a long-delayed prisoner swap, a breakthrough in talks that could possibly be a first step towards an end to the violence. War in Yemen began in 2014, and France 24's Charles Enthaz and Olivier Jobard were there recently for an exclusive report. They made the journey with a group of Ethiopian migrants who, hoping to reach Saudi Arabia, fell in the hands of smugglers in Yemen. Here's a clip from their report that you can find on our website.
It's about crossing the Red Sea, and they're landing now in Yemen, and we'll see where all this goes. Young people, mostly teenagers and very young, in their 20s, looking for a new life in Saudi Arabia. Nothing on their backs. Absolutely nothing. So we were thirsty and starving, she says. It says their face was burned by the sun. They left their home more than 3 weeks ago. And they were hungry and thirsty. They walked day and night. Some of them didn't make it, and they had to be buried in the sand. Unbelievable. One day I'll find a job and it will change my life, she says. And that is why, she says, I left. Unbelievable.
When they arrive in Yemen, migrants step into a different universe, governed by tribal rules and far removed from any official authority. Here, the migration trade takes place in the open, like in this makeshift camp, right next to the coastal road.
Since the war in Yemen started, business has improved for us, someone says. And they've been able to expand. Nothing is organized in the country. The government can't fight us the way it used to before the war. And these migrants are waiting for someone who will take them to Saudi Arabia. They want a better life, and they take advantage of that.
Iran's leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei says casting a vote in the upcoming parliamentary election is a religious duty. But many in the country are deprived of their favored candidates. Thousands of reformists and moderates are banned from running in the ballot, and the population seems disillusioned with devastating U.S. economic sanctions. Many on the streets of Tehran have lost faith in their representatives. In fact, polls suggest that the number of voters who will stay home on Election Day could reach a record of almost 80%. Neither the conservatives nor the reformers are trustworthy. They only care about votes. Our elections are useless. A backdrop to the elections is the Iranian economy suffering under U.S. sanctions and the government's repression of nationwide demonstrations, which broke out last November.
This election is just a show so the world thinks that our leaders are chosen by the nation, and that's not really the case.
Contributing to the apathy of voters, some 7,000 candidates, more than half of the total, have been told they cannot run, disqualified by the all-powerful Guardian Council for not obeying the Islamic establishment. Many of those disqualified are reformists who support Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani. The 71-year-old, whose term ends in August of next year, is still urging people to turn out to vote and has ruled out resigning in the wake of the election.
My resignation would not really make sense. We have made promises to the people, and we will continue to fulfill them, despite the economic situation. But that task will be a tall order for Rouhani, with a government expected to be dominated by conservative hardliners. His position weakened by the United States' withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal and the reimposing of economic sanctions.
Its breathtaking landscapes seem out of this world. Jordan has been the setting for dozens of Hollywood blockbusters. The splendid archaeological city of Petra was the setting for Indiana Jones, while more recently the Wadi Rum Desert welcomed the Star Wars crew. As Monty Francis tells us, it's not just all about the scenery, but also down to money.
The Wadi Rum Desert in Jordan, a jewel of the Middle East. Listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site, it draws tourists from across the globe. Its colorful landscapes have also been a major draw for the film industry. From Lawrence of Arabia in 1962,
now you can either accept that,
to recent blockbusters, including The Martian, starring Matt Damon.
This will come as quite a shock to my crewmates.
Star Wars.
We spotted the fugitives.
Hey, can you make me a prince?
And last year's live-action adaptation of Disney's Aladdin.
It's like when we were in Wadi Rum, I mean, just to walk out, you experience the wonder and awe that you want to infuse the character with.
Here we are at Wadi Rum.
It's also the setting for the much-anticipated remake of Dune from director Denis Villeneuve to be released later this year. During filming last year, one of the stars, Josh Brolin, couldn't resist sharing the view on social media.
Beautiful. Peaceful, quiet, ominous.
Jordan has welcomed Hollywood. In 2003, officials established the Royal Jordanian Film Commission with the goal of making the country what it called a huge outdoor studio. Jordan has offered Hollywood more than just breathtaking landscapes. If a film studio's on-site expenses exceed $1 million, Jordanian authorities have offered a 10 to 25% cash rebate on their expenses in the kingdom. The incentive seems to be working, attracting 29 big-budget films in just the past 5 years.
That's it for me and Middle East Matters this week. Join us again soon and stay tuned to France 24.
Okay, well, that's there, and let me just check one other thing, see if there's anything else that's transpired in very, very recently. I think not. So what I want to do then is quickly look to see what we have for you on Monday. On Monday, oh, yeah, we're going to be speaking to John Bailey, the White Plains Citizenette reporter, publisher, and editor. And then we're going to follow that up with Michael Edelman, political analyst and pundit. And then at 11 o'clock, we're going to speak to Jose Roman, and he speaks to us about issues that pertain predominantly to the Puerto Ricans, as well as the Puerto Rican diaspora. And politics on the local scene in places like Yonkers. And so that'll be it. And then the last half hour, I'll try to clue you in on what's transpired over the weekend, as well as the politics of the day. So that'll be it. And there we go. So whatever the case is, there'll be a wonderful way to start the week next week. And hope you had you will have a great weekend. And so we'll move on from there. So thank you again. Let me just see, move back over here. Where are we? 1 second. Okay, here we are. So we'll wish you a good weekend and shut down a little bit early because I think we've expunged everything that we can today. Be well. Goodbye.